Good afternoon. I'm Parisa Nuruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing the information and inspiration that you need to take action in our city, to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC, and we welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call us at Empower DC at 202-234-9119. And I'm giddy, I think, today because I get to talk for the whole show about organizing with somebody who has a lot of experience with that topic. And, you know, that's one of the things that I could probably sit and talk to somebody about for days and days and days. So thank you so much to Wade Rathke, the founder of ACORN, which grew to be the largest community organization in U.S. history. He led that organization for 38 years as the chief organizer, and today he's here with me in studio. Thanks for joining me, Wade.
Well, it's super to be here. I'm a huge fan of non-commercial radio, and to see other community-based organizations taking advantage. Props to you and Empower DC. Loving on that. Fantastic.
Thanks. Yeah, no, we are very grateful for WPFW, and I understand that in addition to starting ACORN and other organizations that have organized People Power, you also run not one, but what did you say, two or three?
Well, three non-commercial at this point, three stations plus fourth is an internet station. We call them Voice of the People stations, and we got the first one on the air more than 35 years ago, built stations in Tampa, Dallas, and we still run the ones in Little Rock, New Orleans, Greenville, Mississippi, and our internet station. Because low to moderate income people, as you know, don't have a voice, and it was this, that, and the other, but
right. You have to
the chance to really
media.
Get their point of view mm-hmm. over just didn't exist, and we found that out during a campaign where we had an initiative petition around 1976 to try to win what are called lifeline rates in public utilities for seniors and low-income people so that they could get a fixed rate for the first 400 kilowatts of electricity so they could never be shut off. Mm-hmm. And darned if we didn't see the power company spend a couple hundred thousand dollars in the last couple of days. We won the election. We lost it in court. One of the lawyers who fought us in court was nobody knows her name anymore. Hillary Clinton was her name.
I think that name is somewhat familiar.
Yeah. So, yes. And then we talked to a guy, and he said, you know what? You really ought to look at non-commercial radio. And we finally figured out we could get a station. We have a station in Little Rock. It's 100,000 watts, which is huge. And the station in New Orleans is one of the baby low powers at 100. And
so how do people find those stations for those who want to listen online? Or
well, you're what, 89.3?
Yes.
In Little Rock, we're 88.3,
KABF.org.
Nice. In New Orleans, we're WAMF 90.3. So we're just, we're the bread in the middle with you being in our sandwich here with 89.3.
That's beautiful. So I want to take a step back. I'm assuming many of our listeners have heard of ACORN.
Let's hope so.
Yes.
But you know, time passes, and it's not a friendly thing.
Yeah. I mean, maybe some of the youngest listeners may not have heard of it, but I think most of our, because we have a listener base, I think, of people who are pretty keyed in to social movements. But I want to get a little bit of your story because, you know, you founded ACORN in 1970.
Correct.
At 22 years old. Is that correct? Something
21.
Like that. 21.
Yeah.
So what was it that, how did you even find out what an organizer was? I mean, what was it that initially introduced you to organizing?
We had this thing in the late 1960s called the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And we also, that was the tail end of the civil rights movement. Women's movement was starting to move forward. The first sort of scratching of an environmental movement were starting to happen. And so I first dropped out of school in 1968 to organize draft resistance, draft wow. counseling centers in opposition to the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And then went back to school for one semester and was hired as an organizer by National Welfare Rights Organization in Springfield, Massachusetts. And then I just sort of found you know, in those times, you were either part of the solution or you were part of the problem. The whole
right.
war was ending. Revolution was in the air. And so I grabbed a brass ring. There was no time to wait and never look back. I found this fantastic thing called organizing. I'd never heard of it for damn sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I had some modest skills, and it sort of was a way to channel the huge anger I had, which is one of the motivations for everybody organizing. And if you don't tell me it motivates you, I'm not going to believe you.
No, absolutely.
It's deep down for anybody who does this work. And if you've been doing it for 15 years or if I've been doing it to 50, it still burns a fire. And I found this thing called organizing. And then, you know, luckily at 20, 21 years old, you know everything. It's only much later, you know, oh, my God, I knew nothing.
Right.
And what was I doing? So after working for Welfare Rights for less than a year, first in Springfield and then in Boston, that was the largest of the NWRO affiliates. The national headquarters was here in Washington, D.C., 14th Street. I drove by the other day. You know, right. That was post-ghetto riots at that time. George Wiley was the director. But we were being opposed at every corner, and it looks like to me, because, you know, as a green organizer, if we could just widen the base, we had a better chance to win some of the things we were trying to win. And Dr. Wiley had convinced some people that we needed a Southern strategy in order to get adequate income, and needed somebody to go south. And I wouldn't have ever gone to the Midwest, but I'd actually lived in the South, so that didn't seem crazy to me. And I looked at Atlanta, and I looked at other places, and ended up in Little Rock, because that's where the head of the House Ways and Means Committee was at that time, who influenced whether or not you could get welfare legislation. And
so that was a strategic decision on where you – because I was wondering why you started in Arkansas.
Well, there were actually some things that seemed attractive if you wanted to build something like Acorn. I mean, the deal I made with George is, you need something in the South, let me try this thing Acorn. He was over a barrel, so he said yes. And there are very few states, when you think about it, where the largest city is also the capital city, which is also in the geographic center of the state. So if you're going to build a model where you're hoping to build a statewide organization, that's a nice thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that there was significant African-American population, 35-40%, and an income ratio at that point where 70% of the people made less than $7,000 a year meant that even issues in Massachusetts, school lunch was a welfare issue.
Mm-hmm.
In Arkansas, 70% of the people or more were eligible for school lunches if they didn't get them. So you had some ready-built things that you knew you could organize around and win, and that helps if you need a little insurance policy when you're going to some place you've never been and starting just, you know, raw.
Mm-hmm. So where were you actually raised?
I was born in Laramie, Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
My brother was born in Rangeley, Colorado. We were a traveling oil field family, then Kentucky, then ended up in New Orleans, where I went to high school.
Okay.
And then it was too flat and too hot for a Western guy, so I was left high school, never coming back, and ended up, you know, in 1978, moving from Little Rock down to New Orleans just because it was easier to do some of the labor projects and to travel. I mean, it was almost impossible in the 1970s to fly to South Dakota, which is where our second affiliate was. I mean, you had to either fly to Memphis or Dallas.
Mm.
I don't know if the listeners really care about that, but it meant it was almost to fly to South Dakota. It took, you know, 8 to 10 hours to fly there, and it would have taken, you know, hardly 15 to, well, I'm exaggerating. But
you started in Arkansas in 1970. So when did the second chapter open? When did the second state open?
In 1975, January of 1975.
5 years you built, and then you moved into South Dakota.
Right.
Okay. So
we were invited to organize in South Dakota by U.S. Senator Jim Abaresque, who came to the shocking conclusion that even though he was a United States senator and one of 100, he really didn't have enough power to deliver to lower-income people. And he'd heard and read about what we'd done in Arkansas. And it was one of the weirdest meetings I've ever had in my career, to be invited to come to D.C. And you go into the senator's office, and he says, "We need you to go organize against the government in South Dakota." But he was also a very unique guy. He was one of the only—he was Lebanese, so he was one of the only Middle Eastern Senators almost ever still alive out there somewhere, but very progressive, as you can tell. And there you end up. I mean, in South Dakota, it was the next state, and in Texas, and, you know, in that sort of circumference around Arkansas is where we expanded after South Dakota.
And was your original vision that level of expansion, that when you founded Acorn Arkansas?
We wanted to build a model.
So
we wanted to see if it was possible. And Arkansas was a good, I felt, and people who I convinced to join me on this, you know, fool's errand, that if you were in California, New York, Boston, D.C., well, people would always say, well, you know, that works in New York, or that works in Boston, but that wouldn't work in St. Louis or Texas or Iowa. Nobody could ever say if it worked in Arkansas that it wouldn't work freaking everywhere. As I say, we had the right preconditions, we felt, to be successful if we could develop the organizing model, and that's what we spent the first 5 years doing.
And so talk about that model. What was core to the Acorn model?
The first thing that people, listeners, and anybody who's interested in actually organizing has to understand is that we believed in an organizing committee, whether it was workplace organizing or community organizing or whatever, housing block. An organizing committee is made of local people, people indigenous to that particular situation, who are the ones who have to actually do the sweat and bleeding to make the drive happen. And because in the community side, so much of the organizing we did was based on a geographical boundary that tended to be 1,500 to 3,000 families, depending on what the basic size was, we needed a committee that was about 1% of that total that could actually do the work. And in a 4 to 6 week period, concentrated period, could try to hit every one of those doors. You never, as you know, you never talk to everybody, but you could potentially hit 30, 35% of the doors and before the first big meeting and make it a happening. But we needed to, so we spent a lot of time building a local organizing committee, which would then meet on a weekly basis to make decisions on the drive. And in the on the doors, what they were asking people is several things. What issues they felt, and they were repeating and reporting to people on the doors the issues they were hearing from others, whether it was housing and gentrification or loose dogs or no garbage pickup or, you know, whatever it might be. And then hearing the key to all organizing, as you know, is listening. So provoking people to be engaged in that particular home visit exchange so that we could hear what they thought of the issues, what they thought were issues. And then we asked people to join the organization. And our organization was propelled by membership. We were not a 501c3. We were a nonprofit. So if we'd ever made big money, we would have paid taxes. But we never wanted to be in a position where an organizer had to get up in the back of the room and say, oh, you can't.
I know you just voted to do that,
but you can't do that because we have this special status with the U.S. Government about taxes. So, no, we didn't.
So you were never a 501c3.
Never, ever.
So that means you couldn't apply for grants usually then.
Huh?
You couldn't get grant money then usually, unless there was money that was specifically not, you know, tied to you have to be a 501c3.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
we in the family of organizations that Acorn ended up building, we had 501c3s that were part of that family. Our housing corporation that did housing development and rehab and loan counseling was a 501c3. And there were others, the Acorn Institute, that did training and education. So we had 501c3 vehicles, but Acorn itself, the membership organization, which was the heart of the enterprise, was never a 501c3. And I never understood and still don't to this day, and I'm sure it's just because I'm older and ornery. I've never understood why people ever create a C4, because there's nothing you can do with a C4 that you can't do with a plain nonprofit, except you accept restrictions. But, you know, and there are some, you know, we're in the nation's capital, but there are some, like, you know, the Catholic Campaign for Human Development and others who, because their donations come from a wide base, don't have to give to 501c3s, don't have to give to anything but nonprofits, and yet voluntarily restrict themselves to do so. So, You know, that's another campaign I haven't quite won after 50 years, but I'm always looking for recruits.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the ideal system would be for a community organization to not be a 501c3 and to not be dependent on grant money, but to have a membership base similar to a church, I guess, you know, with members who tithe and help sustain.
Or we used to have these things called unions that were powerful in the United States,
right.
And that's a dues system that we learned a lot from. And what we found is that members were all, you know, we were talking about the organizing model, so we would actually ask people to join before the first meeting.
Mm.
Because people really join based on what their hopes and aspirations for the organization are. It's not one of those, we're from Missouri, show me kind of things. Most people were willing to join before the meeting, and then after the meeting, in the meeting, people would both elect officers, and they would vote on what the campaigns were going to be for the first group.
That is that's really interesting, because I think a lot of us would think, oh, you have to develop this long-term relationship and show people, you know, what you can do before you ask somebody to join. But I like what you're saying, that it's, you know, that you're, what you found and it worked is that it was actually based on their hopes and aspirations for what would happen. And then you're building that culture of membership from the start, which I think in my experience, sometimes we don't do that. And then later you're like, oh, and by the way, can you please join?
That's too late. I mean, we wanted people to invest in the organization immediately. If we were going to be able to say this is going to be your organization, frankly, people didn't understand how it could be their organization if they weren't putting any skin in the game. If they didn't, I mean, the dues was, you know, when I left in 2008, it was $10 a month. So we're not talking about a huge amount, but people did understand that's key to the ability of the organization to work. And by the third or fourth organizing committee meeting, there would be a discussion of exactly what the budget of that drive is. So you knew even if you had 100 or 200 members at that time, you couldn't afford a full-time organizer. That's why you had to work with these other three, four groups in order to be able to have an organizer. And those kind of financial realities are what's critical to people really being able to run and direct their own organization, in my view.
Mm-hmm. And so as ACORN grew, and you eventually had, was it 1,200 chapters across the country?
No, it was more like 600, 650, something like that.
So I saw an inflated number in one of the articles.
No, I wish.
About 600, but you did have about 500,000 members.
Right.
And I guess at some point, some of the individual chapters diverged a little bit in their models. Did you observe anything about, you know, what worked best, or was there any part of the model that you would have changed over time, or was it really just what you started with that was the most successful compared to maybe some of the, there was some that became independent, is that correct, some local chapters that became independent of the
national? Well, it was really impossible by our bylaws to ever become independent.
I mean,
it was all right. You're all in, you're all out. So any organizing model that's going to work has to be organic. It has to be able to adapt to changing times. So when I first wrote the model down in 1973, I mean, we still have it on my website. We still use it, but there are many changes to it, whether it's social media or modern communication. We've always tried to incorporate whatever worked within that basic structure. But key things, membership, dues, organizing committees, elected leaders, those things don't change. Those are universal principles virtually ideological concepts within the model. But, you know, out on the branches, many things change. And now on the international level, it's a federation, not just one organization. So there'll be huge differences between what they do in the Czech Republic versus what they do in the UK, where we're largely a tenant union, versus what they do in Canada, which sort of looks exactly like the old U.S., except, you know, 80,000 members and colder, much colder in Canada.
So before we get into more of the details about the international work, so when did you really see that your model was taking off?
In community organizing, as you know, part of how we build mass organization is using issues to build campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were building the first series of local groups, a lot of the campaigns were very specific, very immediate, and where we thought possible, very realizable. And some of the first campaigns had to do with welfare-related issues, because In the first year, we were still affiliated to the National Welfare Rights Organization. But I think there were two episodes early in the organizational history that ended up sort of allowing us to go to another level. One is the decision in 1972 that we would actually involve ourselves directly in politics, mm-hmm. that we would endorse candidates mm-hmm. and, in fact, even run candidates for offices that were nonpartisan, particularly school board officials and this, that, and the other. And in 1972, which was only 2 years after we founded the organization, after more than a generation in which you could not be elected in Little Rock, Arkansas, unless you won in the Fifth Ward, because it was an at-large system, we were able to elect school board members without winning the Fifth Ward, because we were able to mobilize enough voters and register enough voters in low to moderate income precincts to win. And that was a lesson that steered us in a different way, because the tradition in organizing in the early 1970s was strongly influenced by Saul Alinsky, and it was decidedly anti-political. It wasn't just apolitical. It was like, you know, and the roots from Chicago and the Daily Machine. I mean, it's a Saul's conclusion was not necessarily wrong for his time and his particular place, but his argument was very simple, as you know, which is they have money power, we have numbers power, and blah, 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 blah. Well, the problem in organizing is none of our constituency believed that. they didn't believe just because there were more of us than them that we were going to win. So, and particularly if we eschewed any involvement in politics, if they were running after trying to force a mayor to do something or a school, then they needed to.
Because as long as they still had their machine moving, then who cares about what
the mass
of people?
You had to build a people's machine if you're going to contend. You couldn't just take yourself off the field, which is what Saul believed. You had to, in our view, you had to contend for power. If you're saying you're going to build power, you better be willing to win it and lose. And and we were. So the second instance is when we were able to recruit enough candidates in a light election to take over the county government. In 1973, and that was it was an unwieldy system, but it allowed local elections, not citywide elections. So we were able to elect a majority, and it didn't take them long to change the whole constitution so that you couldn't do that anymore. But it was an instance where we were convinced then that we had hit on something. The structure was strong enough, the delivery on the local level was strong enough, that the leaders were good, and they wanted to dream of something bigger and better that they could build. And that made us a little more confident that if we were willing to do the work, that we had people who desperately needed this kind of thing.
And one of the reasons why you're in D.C. right now is because you've just recently published, I think it's your fourth book.
Hey, who's counting? Like who's counting? This is a book that took me almost off and on 15 years to write, because
you'd
get involved in a campaign or Katrina would hit us and you would have to set it aside for a couple of years. But as we worked more and more internationally, and our organizers and leaders would say in this country, well, how did you deal with that? Look, I'll just finish the book and then, you know.
So it's called Nuts and Bolts, The Acorn Fundamentals of Organizing.
Right.
And I know I just glanced at the index and it looks like a real manual for how to do this work. So let me start with this. What is the role of the organizer? For those listeners out there, some of them, you know, we know a lot of people who call themselves organizers. What is the role of the organizer?
In the ACORN system, the role of the organizer was, metaphorically, was more if we were the mechanics in an engine. We didn't get to drive. We didn't build the whole engine, but we helped fine-tune it. We helped make sure there was gas in the tank, and we could point it in a direction, but you had to decide how to steer it, drive it, and whether or not you wanted to go in that direction. So an organizer's job, and we were always very clear, was to build the organization larger. So the basic fundamental contract I had with our leadership was always, as long as they wanted to grow, I was ready to work for them. If they ever tried to restrict part of the growth or to go go against any part of the constituency, then it was my obligation to oppose them and to not work there. And so that's why you have an organizer, is to get as big and as powerful as you want. I mean, and the culture for many coming out of the OEO and model cities and sort of, you know, participation of the 60s LBJ era, was a sort of a precious notion that these little poor people would somehow be able to do it. And even the Alinsky dogma that, you know, an organizer only could stay 3 years and you had to be, you know, hot stepping, and then the car could drive into a wall or it could drive on the highway, or if you follow that metaphor. But we didn't see it that way. We thought that these organizations were trying to build power. They had good leadership. They were democratic. And they needed as many resources as they could get on a permanent basis. I mean, their issues are permanent. Why shouldn't the organization be permanent and institutionalized? And there was always going to be need for somebody to provide and play that role as an organizer or researcher or whatever, because people are working. They're low income, got families, jobs, blah, 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 blah. They need staff support. If a banker can have, you know, a whole staff of bankers to look after the money, well, why couldn't a community organization have a staff of organizers to make sure things were moving towards growth and power?
And so what are some of the key characteristics that you would look for in an organizer candidate and say, okay, this person has the makings to be a good organizer?
We demanded a commitment of at least 2 years. And when we were hiring first in Arkansas, you had to own a car, because there was no public transportation to speak of. So I always made sure that we hired people that had a sense of humor because, you know, you work as part of a team and, you know, you need to. But we had confidence that we could train people. So if we had people who were mobile and motivated and had a good sense of humor, and thankfully, if they possible, had a car, could get a car, we were willing to give people a chance to be organizers.
Mm-hmm. And was there, I mean, I guess some kind of political ideology, I mean, maybe not political, but worldview that they believe they were, you have to be an optimist, don't you, to be an organizer? You have to believe that you can build power to make change.
Well, certainly, I confess to being a romantic in the sense that, you know, you're both very cynical. One foot's in the ground and the other, you know, foot's trying to get into the heavens. So certainly I think that's true of good organizers. We had no political litmus test for organizers. We were confident that once someone learned how to do this work and worked with our members, that they would be able to work, and they had to be accountable to the members. So we really, as long as they didn't try to impose their own politics or jump to the front or take over a leader's role or whatever, we were confident whether they came in sort of wanting to do good, religious social worker, or wanting revolution and, you know, power to the people on the other side. Once they got within the structure of the organization, we were confident that they had a contribution they could make as long as they were willing to do the work.
And so then what's the distinction between the organizer and the leader?
Organizers could not pay dues or be elected to any position nor lead actions. Members elected leaders from their own ranks, paid dues, and or the leaders, press spokespeople, et cetera, et cetera. If a leader was going to join the staff, they had to actually resign from their leadership position and resign as a member. And that happened. We ended up, over the 38 years I ran the organization, hiring a lot of leaders over many years to run the training program, to be researchers, and to be grassroots organizers, housing counselors, whatever the job was.
Mm-hmm. And so the leaders are the directly impacted base.
Right, and they have followers.
Yeah,
the organizers were part of a national system. So if you were an organizer, I had a precious moment last night at Georgetown where we were talking about organizing to a group there, and a young woman came up to me at the end and told me her mother had been an organizer briefly in the 1980s, starting in St. Louis, and then had been transferred to Miami and had died when she was very young, so she didn't know her well, and was looking for people who might have known her mother. And I remember the name, and that's about all. But, I mean, we would train you in one city and then assign you to another city, and then a year or two later assign you to another city before you might be there for, you know, an extended period of time. I mean, it takes several years to train an organizer, frankly.
But your organizers, I mean, were you then accused of bringing in outside agitators because the people doing that work were not from those cities, or was it
even the people who were from the cities were accused of being outside agitators?
Yeah.
I mean,
because that's what the system is going to accuse you if you're going against their policies. Basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nature of this work is you're going to be, you know, helping people who haven't had a voice raise that voice to a very high level and make demands and force change. And so you're always going to be seen as an agitator. Sometimes it's easier for people to do that work not in the community where they were raised, where people have a certain vision of them or know their mother or whatever. But we also would try, we never wanted organizers to be seen as in competition with leaders. So it was always better not to have them work in their own community, even if they were from that particular, I mean, a city like D.C. or this area is big enough you could work in XYZ if you were from ABC.
Because, I mean, a lot of people would say that the best organizers are actually from the community.
Well,
that's
because they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best organizers are the best organizers. You could be from there or not.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I mean,
because
it's all
it's a
work.
Skill set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I never, you know, people, I was 6 feet tall with red hair. People didn't confuse me as being from a lot of the communities where we worked. And so you had to own who you were. And what I was a skill set. I was somebody who knew about organizing. If you didn't want somebody who knew about organizing, whether it was in a mega slum in Korogochi, Nairobi, or in, you know, Harlem or whatever, you didn't need me. And I can appreciate that. But if you wanted somebody who could actually help you build the kind of organization you wanted to build, well, then, you know, I might have some value to you. And that's the way we trained.
But as the organizer, you're also not the spokesperson, as you mentioned, the leader is the spokesperson. So you're not in front of the rally,
right,
giving the speech. You're behind the scenes really, you know, helping
as
to develop that organization.
Yeah.
Before we take a break, let's talk a little bit about the role of confrontation. And one of the things that we deal with a lot in D.C., I'm sure other cities as well, is like this culture of, you know, you have to be, you know, it's inappropriate to act a certain way and calling people out or disrupting. And we're often accused of being confrontational. Of course, we've done everything else first and been ignored. So, you know, we went to the hearing. And we participated in the meetings, all of this. So is confrontation a key part of the organizing that you've been part of, and what role does it play?
We were very avowedly a direct action organization. We believed in members taking collective action immediately after the group was founded. If there wasn't a decision to take action at that first meeting, we knew the group wouldn't survive. Because people in our constituency, they're tired of talk.
Yeah.
They're not looking for a, you know, task force. They're not looking to do committee work. They want to know that the organization they're paying dues to is really going to fight. And when people would say, well, what can we get from being a member of ACORN? Or what can the union give? All we give you is the ability to fight. If you want to fight, this is a place for you. If you don't want to fight,
right,
you know, we respect you. Good luck. You know, we'll be good neighbors. But this is an organization that's going to help you win.
And but you, how do you get when people are saying, well, will this, you know, will we win if we do this? I mean, how do you answer that?
We are committed to this fight as long as it takes to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we were known for our persistence.
Yes.
I mean, we just won an issue getting landlord licensing in Toronto that took 14, 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's a saying in the South, I don't know if it's common here in D.C., that you can beat us, but you're going to have to whip us first.
Mm.
So, I mean, we live that. I mean, we just dug in, and we might have to step back and give a little ground, but we were going to be back on those issues as long as it took to win, and that's what builds you power and respect that and other issues as well. You may not win that issue for years, but you may win another 10 at the same time, because who wants to fight with an organization like ACORN or with direct action?
Yeah, you have to be real stubborn. I've been working on the same thing for 18 years. So,
well, and you know, I'll say one more thing before the break.
Yes.
I mean, if we had $10 for everyone who told us, and I bet this is true for you too, that we really believe in ACORN, but we just don't like your tactics. You know, we believe in what you're trying to do. We just don't like the way you're doing
exactly
it.
Exactly right.
Really, all they're saying is, you know, can't y'all just be calm and just lay back?
Be co-opted.
And take a beating.
Yeah.
Can't you just take a beating? No, no, we can't take a beating. If we wanted to take a beating, we would have not built the organization, because people, there's always a history, we find there's always a history of struggle in every situation where we organize. So part of what we're listening for when we build a group, like I say, whether it's in a neighborhood or workplace or whatever, is what is that history of struggle that we can build on?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to take a quick music break. We'll be right back. And if you have comments or questions for Wade Rathke, founder of ACORN, please call us at 202-588-0893. We'll be right back.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Hardening crimes is a part of the times. And it's rough for some people to live. Disease can move fast, but it don't have to last. It is now the nation's turn for all to be concerned. We can be freer still. It is the people's will. And bring back the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people.
All right, we're back on Taking Action, WPFW 89.3 FM, and I'm in the studio with Wade Rathke, the founder of ACORN, which grew to be the largest community organization in the United States, and he's actually working internationally as well with ACORN International. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. If you have any comments or questions for Wade, give us a call at 202-588-0893. So you left the ACORN in U.S. in, I think it was 2008,
right.
But you remain the chief organizer of ACORN International. How did the international piece come to existence?
The community in the United States is very diverse. So as soon as we started winning in various cities, people who were from Mexico or Dominican Republic or wherever, Peru, that had come to the United States for various reasons, some because they were in political exile, like Peruvians, some because of economic reasons, whatever it might have been, wanted to see something like this in their home country. So for years and years, we said, no, we don't have any ability, whatever. And the first country we ended up working with was in Peru. We had leaders and organizers who had fled Peru during the Fujimori dictatorship and ended up either concentrated in New Jersey largely or in the Los Angeles area. And so when Fujimori was deposed and Toledo took over, we were forced, the board demanded we go down and see if there was any way we could offer to help. So on this sort of fool's mission, we went down there. We're there a week, me and one of our organizers and I can't remember who else was there, probably just the two of us. And literally the last meeting we had before we left, because the government was in chaos, they hadn't been funded yet, so you were literally meeting with the chief of staff in the Palacio at 11:30 at night because they all had other jobs and were coming to run the government after work. It was all crazy.
Mm.
We met this group of people who were running comedores, who were 1,500 food kitchens throughout Lima, and they wanted to. They convinced me that they wanted to change the scope of their organization from food to health to housing to other things. So in the spirit of the times, we offered to loan them an organizer for several months and to train some of their leaders in our Los Angeles office. And one thing leads to another. We ended up also creating a partnership with the union, the Water Workers Union, which had been decimated. We'd fought against privatization of water successfully in Atlanta and New Orleans, and they were fighting the same global companies throughout Peru. So the next thing you know, about 17 years ago, there we were in Peru. And once you're there, you start listening. And we ended up in the mega slum San Juan Lurigancho, which is 1.5 million people on the outskirts of town, squatting community. And away you go. Then next was Mexico and Canada. And for a long time, we basically focused on back to the roots of ACORN on very La Matanza outside of Buenos Aires, Endesa outside of Mexico City, Mumbai, you know, Dharavi and Coragochu and, you know, mega slums around the world. And then, but if you, I have a terrible problem if you contact me and throw by Facebook or random or whatever, because I've hit so many doors cold. I mean, I respect people who come out of the blue,
yeah.
Crazy as that is. And if somebody says they really want to organize this campaign in Rome, or, you know, want to see about coming, you know, coming to in with us from France or whatever, I don't know how to say no. I would make a Skype call and arrange to visit, and some of that played out and some of it didn't. Next thing you know, 15, 17 years have gone by. Our largest affiliate is in Canada with 80,000 members and India with about 50,000.
Wow.
Of whom 35,000 are in a union that we built in Bengaluru area. Of street vendors, hawkers, whatever. And then France and the UK are largely, I mean, UK is tenants union. So you do what the need is.
Is the model basically the same, or yes. has it had to evolve to different cultural, you know, dynamics or political dynamics?
What I always say, every place is different.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been to a place where people did not tell me this will never work. Because every place, this will never work. People never pay dues. They'll never do this. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
it is different. The dues the same equivalency, $10 per month, sort of the equivalent of that for
right.
India?
Right. It's, you know, three soles in Peru. It's, you know, 50 rupees in India. It's 5 euros in France. It's 6-7 pounds in the UK. You know, so but they pick their rate because it's a federation, which is always, you know, there's a lot more differences in the world of ACORN International between organizations than there was in the world of US ACORN back in the day. But
so
but it's still rock and roll.
Do you think that organizing is part of American culture, or do we actually need to, are we sort of trying to make it part of American culture? Because I mean, I think that there's aspects, right? We got unions, we got churches where people organize, there's some community organization, but I feel like it's not enough part of our culture, or maybe it's been diminished over time that so many people are not accustomed to being part of an organization, especially a member-led organization. And that seems to be one of our biggest barriers. What is your thought on that?
My thought is I agree with your point that almost all membership institutions are fading. I mean, we're looking at the density for labor unions now going down towards 5% in the private sector. I mean, we're looking at church attendance, you know, plummeting. I mean, not just the Catholic Church. So, in fact, organization is not part of the U.S. culture. We're watching that fade first in television and now with the Internet. So we're riding against the stream hard, but you do need organization to take the kind of action that's necessary for change.
Yeah. And so you do a lot of training also of organizers. What are some of the most common mistakes that you see organizations or organizers making?
There's a lot of things people do naturally well, and there's a lot of things that you know, don't necessarily seem like proportionality is one problem a lot of organizations have. I mean, in campaigns, you need to make sure the tactic is appropriate to the target. You need to build momentum over the course of a campaign. You can't lead with your best punch. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. so that takes experience. It's a learned thing. It's not something that comes naturally. But a lot of people, you know, fighting community benefit agreements or get involved in high-low bargaining, which is always a disaster. You're asking for the moon and thinking somebody's going to good faith give you half a moon and you'll come out somewhere in the middle. And that's just not the way real negotiations work, and it's not the way power works. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to very carefully tailor your demands to within a hair of what you intend to win and to intend to fight for, because people don't fight hard for unrealistic goals, and they never want to settle without, you know, I think often not making sure in coalitions, which are very important, that we have very clear and firm rules of engagement is fatal to most coalitions. I mean, when we talk about people being co-opted or bought out, it's because often we weren't clear enough about the rules of engagement and allowed that to happen. So I could go on. I mean, I think the most common problem in all organizing is not acting. There's always a million reasons not to do something, but there are good reasons to do something, and we need to act. And if we're persistent, we can outrun most of our mistakes. That's what 50 years has taught me. I mean, we don't know everything, but if we aren't willing to quit and continue to fight, we have a chance of winning.
Yeah. What is the vision that you have for the type of power that you seek to build through organizing? What would happen if you had that power? How would decision making change? You know, what's your, I guess, your vision, or how would you describe that to people that you're working with, what that power would mean?
Well, we organize groups of low and moderate income families. Mm-hmm. So that's based on a concept that the majority and the kind of government we have should have a majority voice. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about an issue that's finally being recognized in this country, the vast inequality, particularly that's been created over the last 20 years, certainly having a majority of power proportionate to the numbers in a democracy, not based on the money primary, as they used to talk about in elections, but based on, you know, a functioning democracy where everybody has the ability to vote, everybody does get a say, you'd see a lot different. I mean, you wouldn't see the kind of inequality we have. You wouldn't see people not allowed to be, you know, part of the voice.
Mm-hmm. And so it is clear that the work that you've done has not been based on moving an issue. It's been based on building power, right? So the issues are a vehicle to get people involved in organizing and building organization. Is that your sort of?
We use issues and campaigns as organizing tools to build organization, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because you know, here you are in D.C. I know you've been here before. You know, you see what's happening in our city.
I do a lot to not be here, yeah.
But well, yeah, I saw your blog was a little bit anti-D.C., and I want to remind you that the government is not the same as the actual city of D.C. and the neighborhoods and the people and the culture that exists here.
Love
who've been
DC
struggling.
People.
Right, okay, so just so we're clear.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the biggest issues that we are dealing with here is, of course, gentrification and displacement and housing issues. You know, are you seeing that as one of the core issues
globally?
Everywhere? Globally?
Oh, it's, I mean, you can't, I mean, that's why we have largely, you know, no matter how many times our groups are voting in the UK, housing is always the first issue. And it's why we increasingly call ourselves a tenants union, because people cannot afford to rent. And they definitely, I mean, the notion of buying a house, nobody who's coming up now in the working class or low or moderate income in the UK believes they'll ever own a house. I mean, you'd have to move to God knows where. So those issues are commonplace. And gentrification, whether you're in, you know, Frankfurt, Germany, or Dublin, or, you know, the U.S., I mean, there are executive cities, San Francisco, Vancouver, Seattle, where, you know, none of us could ever pretend that people can live. And our Vancouver organization, we don't have any members in Vancouver. They're all in the suburbs, Burnaby, Surrey, New Westminster. So, I mean, we think a huge issue is gentrification every place, but there's not a consensus on what it takes to win yet.
Mm. And you are based in New Orleans, so obviously that's been a major issue in New Orleans as well.
Post the storm, if you were in an area that didn't flood, the which is where I live, I mean, all of a sudden values, rents have more than doubled, housing values have gone to, you know, up 4 and 5 times, and people literally aren't sure if they can afford the property taxes anymore. We have a smaller city that now is trying to collect more from what's left. I mean, we're still 85,000 people short of what we had in 2005.
So, you know, in our last few minutes, we have, again, the book that you have just come out with, Nuts and Bolts, The Acorn Fundamentals of Organizing, also the film that you're featured in, The Organizer. So how can people get these things? How can they follow you and read your daily blog posts? It looks like that you're pretty prolific over here.
Well, you know, we work for a living. Look, if you're anywhere in the listening area near Towson, Maryland, which is outside of Baltimore, I'm going to be there tonight at 7. The movie is going to be shown, The Organizer, and there's going to be questions and answers afterwards. That's at 1220 East Joppa Road. The that's the office building of the Teachers Association of Maryland, TABCO. Mm-hmm. To get the book, socialpolicy.org is the publisher, and you can the movie is now available on iTunes. This is not our movie. I wish we got a piece of it, because it certainly took them 8 or 9 years to do. We thought it would never be, and we don't agree with all of it, but it's got some great archival footage, and it's good on the story of people and leaders working hard to build power. So we also have it available through our website. If people want to follow my blog or look at the podcast or our radio stations, www.chieforganizer.org. Affiliatedmediamovement.org is where you can also listen to 2,500 hours of broadcast from our radio stations.
Great.
Great being with you.
And as we close out, I want you to leave us with, you know, you've been doing this 50 years, I think, or so. So what is it that keeps you moving? I mean, a lot of people are burning out. A lot of people are, you know, I don't know if this is for me. You know, people go to organizer trainings. They're an organizer for a couple years, and then they say, oh, I was an organizer once. So how do you keep moving? What keeps you going?
Well, absolutely, organizing is not for everybody, and we're honest about that. But in my case, and I think many the cases of many people who do this as their lifetime's mission, there's an abiding sense of anger about the injustice in our world and the fact that the people we organize don't have that say or that amount of power. And that anger is still as white hot in my soul as it was when I first, you know, started organizing at 19, 20 years old. I was lucky to find a constructive way to use that anger. But I think we need more people who can make a contribution to this work, whether it's a couple of 4 or 5 years or whether it's a lifetime. We need a people's army to change what we have. And we try to use the contribution. I mean, all of our radio stations are 100% volunteer. I mean, what a win. And believe me, there's nobody that funds you to go build power for low to moderate income people
right.
around the world. I mean, that's just not something that, oh, I really want to donate a couple million dollars to that. I mean, that's not going to happen. So we need people who are ready to do it. For burnout, people lose their way, but I've never met anybody who burned out. I mean, but it's hard work, and we just think we'll help anybody who wants to do it. But my email is chieforganizer@acorninternational.org, or it's wade@chieforganizer.org. If you're interested in organizing anywhere in the U.S. or elsewhere, get in touch. We're always glad to help.
I appreciate that, Wade. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today on Taking Action. Folks, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Inside Out, but first the news with Rob Sims.
Good afternoon. These are the headlines. I'm Rob Sims. British lawmakers were preparing to blow open the Brexit process and put a host of rejected options back on the table, including keeping the UK close to the European Union or even remaining a member, as Prime Minister Theresa May defiantly insisted today that Parliament should approve her twice-defeated divorce deal instead. Lawmakers are scheduled to vote tomorrow on multiple flavors of Brexit after the House of Commons voted to wrest the parliamentary timetable away from May's weakened government and hold votes on alternatives to her rejected withdrawal agreement. Cyclone-ravaged Mozambique faces a second disaster from cholera and other diseases. That said, the World Health Organization, they warned today that while relief operations pressed into rural areas where an unknown member of people remain without aid more than 10 days after the storm. Some 1.8 million people in Mozambique need urgent help after Cyclone Idai, the United Nations said in an emergency appeal for $282 million for the next 3 months. The death toll in Mozambique from the cyclone has risen to 468, according to Mozambican authorities, cited by the Portuguese news agency Lusa. There are also 259 dead in Zimbabwe and at least 56 dead in Malawi. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has vetoed a bill that would bar convicted felons of being notary publics even if they had their civil rights restored after serving their sentences. Northam announced the veto on Friday, saying that the legislation was antithetical to the concept of restorative justice. The legislation would bar people from ever being notaries if they had been convicted of certain felonies, including fraud, robbery, bribery, and treason. The legislation had broad support in the General Assembly, including a unanimous vote in the Senate. Lawmakers will take up Northam's vetoes next month during a one-day session. A two-thirds vote in both chambers is needed to override a veto. A judge who played a role in Kansas's first same-sex marriage has announced his retirement. The Kansas Office on Judicial Administration says Johnson County District Judge Kevin Moriarty will retire on June 28th. In October 2014, Moriarty ordered the county to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples following the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to hear appeals from five states seeking to preserve their bans on gay marriage. Moriarty said at the time that his ruling was meant to avoid confusion about the legal climate surrounding gay marriages. His ruling led to the state's first same-sex wedding and a contentious legal fight. A failed drive was started to oust Moriarty from the bench before the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately declared a nationwide right to same-sex marriage in June 2015. In area weather this afternoon, sunny skies, the highs near 52. North winds 11 miles per hour, gusting as high as 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear skies, the lows around 32. Currently in downtown Washington, the temperature 48 degrees, under fair skies. I'll have the next newscast at 2:55. The Inside Out Collective is next here on WPFW Washington. It's 2 o'clock.
WPFW's birthday and the close of Women's History Month with a bang, a very special evening of performance by the incomparable Cassandra Wilson. That's right, WPFW presents Cassandra Wilson at Bethesda Blues and Jazz on Friday, March 29th at 8 p.m. This night to remember is a fundraiser for WPFW as we enter our 42nd year. A limited number of tickets are $100, which includes premium seating and a meet and greet with Ms. Wilson.